always tries to embarrass me. Since I get to be good cop today, I can feel the love. It's a very rare occurrence that I get to be good cop. Usually Darren plays the part of good cop when we're doing these things together. So, koe koe, niltaliwis, wanahamogasit, nejeobanawapskeg, and delnabamuk, awasus, nilbanawapskeg, nagagagagus, niltsabayeg, nalita haziu and dayan. My name is Sherry Mitchell. I'm from the Penobscot Nation. My family is Bear Clan from the Penobscot Nation and Crow Clan from the Passamaquoddy Tribe at Zibayik. I'm very happy to be here with you today. One of the things that Hugh mentioned is that Arnie Nace, who is the founder of the modern-day deep ecology movement, there is something that he had talked about that I think is really important to help frame the discussion, at least for this piece of it today. One of the things that he talked about was this perspective that was vital to the emergence of the deep ecology movement, and that was understanding indigenous worldview and perspectives and being able to translate that into some meaningful format moving forward. The joke that I always tell when people spend a lot of time with a lot of people all over the world, and one of the jokes that I like to tell is that I like to walk with people in the woods and say, do you hear the birds still singing? Yeah, I hear the birds still singing. Do you hear the other animals around you continuing to go about their business? Yep, I heard that. I said, do you know why that is? And they say, no, I don't know why that is. I said, because as indigenous people, we were never kicked out of the garden. So we still have a relationship with the natural world. So sometimes that goes over really well, and sometimes it doesn't. So, but I think it's important to understand that there's a basic worldview, a foundational philosophy that some indigenous people have been raised with that is now emerging into the mainstream and being embraced by people all over the world. And so I'd like to start out this morning talking about that. And I also want to mention something that Darren talked about process. And I think that we often talk in sound bites. We're always limited. We're getting bombarded with thousands, hundreds of thousands of images a day of the path of destruction. And when we're talking about these types of things, we're talking about them in sound bites. And so that doesn't really give us the opportunity to have that meaningful processing of these issues, to have meaningful discussions about what does it feel like in your body? You know, how are you impacted by these things? And how do we take all that we've come to know and apply that in effective ways moving forward? So I think that that's really important to think about as we go through this little process together of having this discussion. So I'd like to start out this morning by telling you a story. Those of you who have heard me speak before, when I'm talking about environmental issues, I always frame those discussions with this opening story because I think that it's really important for us to start from this place. So this is a story of origin and worldview, and I think that it is fundamental to shaping our movement forward. So the land that we're standing on right now is a traditional homeland of the Wabanaki. For many, the land of their birth is seen as an extension of their bloodline, not in a purely metaphorical sense, but through tangible connections to the flesh, bone, and blood of the ancestors that have lived and died there. There was a Crow elder named Shiskro who said, "The soil you see beneath your feet is not ordinary soil. It is the dust of the blood, the flesh, and the bones of our ancestors. The land as it is my blood and my dead. The land beneath this building holds the dust of the blood, the flesh, and the bones of my ancestors. And to honor them, I'd like to ask all of you to stand with me and recognize a moment of silence to acknowledge their presence here." Thank you. Please be seated. there's a subtlety to the language of creation. And when we begin to comprehend the subtle language of creation, we start to see that there's an underlying structure that supports all life on this planet. Our ears become attuned to new frequencies, and we find that we're able to hear the voices of the trees and understand the buzzing of the bees. And we realize that it's the interwoven substance of these floating rhythms that moves throughout creation that holds us in delicate balance with all life. And then, perhaps for the first time in our lives, we're able to witness that there is a perfectly orchestrated dance of creation and to see the delicate balance that exists within it. We recognize that when the trees breathe in carbon dioxide and release oxygen, our lungs automatically mirror that movement by breathing in the oxygen that is generously given and releasing carbon dioxide back to the trees. We see our connectivity and interdependence with one another, and we understand that our web of kinship extends far beyond our human family. My tribe has a number of creation stories. Every story tells us a different aspect of our being. One of those stories tells us that we were created when Glooskap, who was the man from nothing, shot an arrow into the ash tree and opened a doorway into this world. This story teaches us that we are made of the same foundational elements that make up the natural world. In this story, we are born out of the ash tree. Thus, the ash tree is our kin and should be honored in the same way that we honor our human family. Today, our tribes still recognize our relationship with the ash tree by weaving our traditional baskets from its pulp. When we weave those baskets, we're reminding ourselves that we are woven from the same foundational elements that make up all life. When we go into ceremony, the story changes. Our creation stories then begin in the stars. When we enter the lodge, we're taught that our original instructions are contained in those stars. It is held in the dust of creation that lingers on the Creator's hand. And it is from the radiance of that stardust that we are born and the great migration of souls first began. Here we learn that we are connected to something larger than this world. We are comprised of stardust and water, and our kinship network extends far out into the universe. When we enter into this universe, we are born into our first ecosystem, our mother's womb. There we are nurtured and sustained through an umbilical connection to the body of our birth mother. Then, when we are born into this world, our umbilical connection is transferred from our birth mother to the earth mother. Our umbilical connection with the Earth Mother then nurtures and sustains us for the remainder of our human lives. An awareness of this umbilical connection is at the heart of the Indigenous relationship with the land. Indigenous peoples have strong ties to their homelands. These ties extend beyond Western ideas of property ownership, incorporating a familial relationship and maternal connection to the land of one's birth. When I'm asked who I am and where I come from, I'm able to answer with one word, Banawabskik. I was born and raised on the traditional homelands of the Penobscot Nation, which is located in the waters of the Penobscot River. This land has been occupied by the Penobscot people for more than 10,000 years. For me, being Banawabskik means that my roots are embedded in the land and nourished by the waters of the Penobscot River. We are deeply entwined, me, the land, and those waters, and I'm connected to generations of others who have their roots embedded in that same land, past, present, and future. When I define myself as Banawabskik, I express how my deep connection to that place makes the distinction between the land, those waters, and who I believe myself to be indistinguishable. This one simple statement begins to paint the picture of the basic worldview that frames my reality. This worldview, though personal and unique, is formed of a framework that is shared by people across the globe. This foundational framework is the key to our discussion. We all have deep umbilical connections to Mother Earth, and we are all reliant upon her and one another for our survival. So I'm an attorney, and I do Indigenous rights law and environmental justice work. I also do a lot of nonviolence and mediation training. So my daily life is often embedded in this idea of law. And so all law is based in some form of agreement, some form of common agreement, generally. and every agreement has elements of both rights and responsibilities. When we talk about rights from an Indigenous perspective, we recognize that they are inextricably tied to a set of responsibilities. In fact, we recognize that all of the rights that we stand upon are derived from an agreement that is equally weighted with responsibility, which requires us to maintain a balanced position with the world that we inhabit. In our language, the word for treaty or agreement is Lagudwagen. Literally translated, what this means is entering into kinship with another. It is understood that the forming of an agreement is the forming of a relationship. Entering into Lagudwagen means that we're making a commitment to bring the other party into our lives, to honor and respect them as we would our own blood kin. That relationship provides us with some benefit, but it also requires us to take on a set of responsibilities so that we may legitimately claim the benefit that's being offered. When we discuss our rights traditionally, we recognize that those rights do not originate with the laws of man. All of the rights that we claim are bound by our first treaty. It is this treaty that gives us all of the rights that we claim under the laws of man. In order to claim these rights, we must honor the responsibilities that we accepted. The responsibilities that we accepted under that agreement were to live in harmony with the natural world and all living beings. For thousands of years, that agreement has served us well. But then a new frame of thought entered this land and created imbalance with the way of life that we had enjoyed. This new frame of thought included a number of rights and entitlements, but it did not come with a sense of balancing responsibilities towards all life. As a result of this imbalanced view, people became lost, and the unchanging laws of nature were overshadowed by the constantly shifting laws of man. When I think about rights and responsibilities, those thoughts are framed by my specific cultural understanding about my place in a balanced and harmonious world. Unfortunately, it's a world that appears to be little more than mythology at the present time. As I stated earlier, our tribal stories teach us that our inherent rights as Skijinawi, as Native people, are derived from our first treaty or agreement, the agreement that we made with the Creator when we first emerged into this world. This provides us with the foundational authority for all of the rights that we stand on today. Under this agreement, we have the right to live unencumbered on this land with full access to all of the sources of our survival. We don't view these things as resources. They are the sources of our survival. They are not resources to be exploited and commodified. Things such as water, food, shelter. We have the opportunity to enjoy these things as long as we uphold our responsibility to live in balanced harmony with the rest of creation. We understand that these rights are not self-evident or self-generating. They are strengthened or weakened by the degree of responsibility that we take to uphold our part of the agreement. The way that we have honored that agreement in my community is by living in respectful balance with our land and waterways for thousands of years. The evidence of our continued adherence can be found in the core principles that have been woven into the practices of our modern-day tribal governance. It can be seen in the conscious steps that we have taken to honor and protect the lands and waters that we inhabit. It can be seen in harvesting limits that are found in our forestry programs, in fish and game laws that take careful measures to ensure the sustainability of our traditional food sources, in decades-long restoration projects that have restored and revitalized the waters of the Penobscot River, and in the creation of land and water quality standards that protect and sustain the health of our lands and waterways for all current and future generations. Taking active responsibility for our obligations under this agreement provides a natural balance and a solid footing for the rights that we claim. Without this balance, we would destroy the very ground that these rights are built upon. If we want evidence of this truth, we don't have to look very far. We only have to look at the unchecked destruction of the natural world that is being caused by capitalist greed. The failure of industry to take responsibility for the destruction of our planet and our complacency and complicity are quickly taking away our right to exist here on Mother Earth. Of course, what I'm talking about here up to this point have been the laws of creation, which are not generally aligned with the laws of man. As human beings, we have fallen out of step with the rest of creation. We have lost our way and overinflated our sense of value. In doing so, we have walked away from the natural law that keeps this world in balance. As a result, the entire creation has suffered. Man's attempt to regain this balance has resulted in a series of legal obligations that inform us how we are to treat one another, because we've forgotten. Everywhere we look, people are crying out to have their rights honored, respected, and upheld. Though society has done a good job of declaring and defining rights of human beings, it has done a poor job of applying those rights evenly to all populations. And in most instances, it has completely failed to harmonize those rights with the rights of Mother Earth and all other living beings. Though we have made significant progress in many ways, the equation involving our rights is still largely aspirational and grossly imbalanced. In my opinion, my humble opinion, this inequity is caused by our failure to balance those rights with a set of humane responsibilities toward one another and the rest of creation. Under man-made law, rights are defined as legal, social, or ethical principles of freedom or entitlement. They are the rules by which a society defines itself. Among the many rights that we have defined for ourselves are a set of evolving human rights. Human rights have been expressed and guaranteed by law in countless ways. They have been outlined by treaty, identified in the practices of customary international law, embedded in the tenets of constitutional law, and incorporated into the language of numerous human rights acts, conventions, declarations, and resolutions. These laws place obligations on governments and government agencies to act in certain ways or to refrain from certain acts in order to promote and protect the rights and fundamental freedoms of individuals or groups. All of these rights are claimed to be indivisible and interrelated and interdependent. The development of one enables the advancement of the other, and the deprivation of any adversely affects them all. Though these rights have not been equally protected or supported for all, they have been globally acknowledged. Most world governments and countless human rights organizations have declared that basic human rights are inherent and inalienable. But what does that mean? An inherent right is one that is existing in someone or something as a permanent and inseparable element, quality, or attribute. An inalienable right is often described as a right that no one can give you, but that no one can take from you. Without deeper thought, it would seem that these rights stand alone as self-originating truths. But when we look deeper, we begin to realize that the world rightfully operates on principles of balance. This suggests that there is some countermeasure necessary to stabilize these rights within the society. Throughout history, we've been seeking to find this balance, and perhaps that's the root of the problem. Rather than seeking to find the balance, perhaps it would be more effective if we actively worked to create it. There is a countermeasure necessary to balance the rights that we now claim. That countermeasure is responsibility. And its enormous weight is one that must be shouldered by us all. Though these laws are vital to securing our freedoms and liberties, they fail to take into consideration the need to balance the place of human beings within the larger context of creation. In order to achieve true balance, we must work to extend those rights to all living beings and to Mother Earth herself. If we hope to live in a society where rights are valued, then we have to be willing to adopt an ethical stance toward our inherent responsibilities as human beings. First, we must recognize that an exclusive and empty insistence on rights creates a vacuum of need that can never be fulfilled. Demanding rights without taking responsibility creates a warped sense of entitlement that leads to violence, lawlessness, and chaos. History has proven this to be true. Who are willing to act with honor and justness to secure those rights for all. When my tribe decided that the Penobscot River needed to be cleaned of the decades of toxic waste created by industry, They didn't simply stand up and claim a right to clean water. Instead, they worked in concert with numerous users up and down the Penobscot waterways. And they took on the responsibility of cleaning those waters for the benefit of all current and future users. We recognized that if we wanted to claim the right to clean water for our own people, then we had to take responsibility for ensuring clean water for everyone. When we looked at our right to subsistence living, we recognized that this also came with a set of unique responsibilities. In order to properly claim those rights, we had to work to protect the rights of Mother Earth to exist with all of her ecological systems and biodiversity intact, in order to ensure that the wildlife in our territories could live and thrive upon those lands. In doing so, we acknowledged that our rights were interdependent, tied to the rights of all of the other living beings that made their home there. The same principle translates into our individual lives and the work that we're doing collectively to protect both human and earth-based rights. It helps us to remember that our demand for rights must be balanced with a set of clear responsibilities. We must be willing to do more than make a demand. We must be willing to actively work to create a world where that demand can be met. We cannot claim a right to clean water without taking responsibility for actively ensuring that the contamination and overuse of the water is eliminated. We cannot claim a right to clean air without taking responsibility for the creation of healthy and sustainable energy sources and industrial practices. We cannot claim a right to a more equitable economy without taking responsibility for where and how we spend our money. We cannot claim a right to ethical leadership without taking responsibility for voting in candidates that we believe in rather than those we believe can win. And we cannot claim a right to life without taking responsibility for the lives that have already been created. And we cannot claim a right to peace without taking responsibility for cultivating peace within ourselves and in our relationships with one another, even those that we oppose. When our rights are not balanced with a solid sense of responsibility, we lean toward dependency and begin blaming others for the problems that we face. And we begin demanding that others step in and solve these problems. We point fingers, we accuse, we condemn, we blame. We become increasingly angry when our demands aren't met, and then we lash out in anger. This is where we depart decisively from humanity's most basic moral compass. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. When we demand something for ourselves that we are not willing to ensure for others, our demand loses all of its power. When we fail to take responsibility for the condition of our lives and the lives of those around us, we relinquish the power to chart our own course and the course of humanity. We also surrender our ability to change the world. However, when we take even the smallest steps to accept the responsibility needed to balance our own demands, we immediately begin to change the world around us. If we truly hope to create change, we must remember that we have the power to make change happen. We must remember that we're all connected. When we pray, we end our prayers with Ndilnabamuk. Ndilnabamuk means to all of my relations. This reminds us that we cannot ask for anything for ourselves without the entire creation being impacted. Everything that we do has an impact on the larger structure of life, and we can't claim anything for ourselves without being consciously aware of how it impacts all others within that system. We do have the power to create this type of change. We have the power to completely divest our lives and financial resources from harmful practices that threaten life on this planet. We have the power to disengage from fear-mongering and sensationalism and all of the other discordant tactics that are used to try to divide us. We must remember to stand up for one another and to communicate with one another in the spirit of unity. We must remember to see one another as kin. We must remember that we have the collective power to direct our economic and political systems and move them away from the practices of domination and destruction and move them back toward a more humane and restorative path. We must remember that we are all co-creators of the reality that we inhabit, and that we have the freedom to choose a new path. When we balance our demand for rights with an acceptance of our responsibility toward one another and all other living beings, we take back our own power. We can begin this process of charting a new path forward by balancing the rights that we claim with a corresponding action that ensures those rights for all. Then piece by piece, we'll build a foundation for a rights-based society that is balanced, just, and harmonious. Maybe it won't be fast, maybe it won't be easy, but I can guarantee you that it won't happen at all if we don't make it happen. As you move forward today and contemplate ideas of deep ecology, I encourage you to think about yourself as part of the entire creation. Instead of seeing only problems that need to be solved, siloed, individualized problems, look for a collective solution. Look for ways that we can put forth a solution that allows us to take responsibility for that which we're asking for. By taking active responsibility for the conditions that are disrupting our harmony and balance, we will be able to change the world in ways that we can't even imagine when we're trying to simply topple the existing systems. If we only focus on trying to topple the existing systems, when they are toppled, there will be nothing for us to step into. If we want to inhabit a world that is more just, humane, and balanced, and sustainable, we are responsible for creating it. The greatest threat that exists to Mother Earth today is the belief that somebody else will come along and save her. We are the ones who are responsible for doing this work. And so long as we try to pass that off on somebody else by casting blame, nothing will ever change. And so what gives me hope is that I do this work all over the Americas. I meet with wonderful people like you who are very caring and compassionate, who are committed to doing this work. And doing a little math of some of the historical movements that have really behave, maybe not in our consciousness, because we're seeing some of the undercurrents of some of those changes rise to the surface today. But what encourages me is that there are people all over the world that are doing this. And if we look at the numbers in this country, what we need, because I believe that we have millions of people who are awake, but what we need are 11 million people who are committed and active and working in a unified way toward creating change. And I don't mean that in a homogenized sense, because one of the things that I think is really defeatist to our movement of movements is to try to homogenize them. Because if you think about a laser, okay, a laser has an incredible amount of power when it's concentrated, but when that light beam is diffused over a large surface area, all of the power of that laser is taken out. And so it's important for us to have our individual focus, right? I can't do everything, and if I try to do everything, I would be completely ineffective. The reason that I'm effective at what I do is because I'm able to focus myself on the specific area of expertise that I've been charged with carrying, right? And so we do that not by homogenizing into one large movement, but by homogenizing our idea of what that looks like, I guess. So we change our idea into a unified idea of what that looks like, but we maintain our individuality, we maintain our individual areas of focus, and we maintain the power and the pressure and presence that we aim in that specific area. We have a word in our language called smogness, and I like to talk about this because I think it's really important to stop seeing everybody else as an enemy that doesn't agree with us. Because if we're trying to create a unified, more just, and harmonious world, we can't continue to have ideas of other that need to be conquered. That's conquest mentality, which led us to this place that we're in today. We need to shift that way of thinking, right? And so with smogness, you're not trying to harm the other. you're just using enough force to hold the other at bay, but not using enough force to harm them. You're preventing them from harming you any further, but you're not engaging in a way that harms them. We need to give people a place where they can move to, which means we need to create new systems for them to step into, because people still need to support their families, right? So we have to start thinking about the way that we do this work in a new way and take it out of the mentality of conquest and start immersing it in this idea of oneness, of interrelatedness, interconnectedness, and kinship. If somebody in your family was hurt, if they were confused, if they were making bad choices, my hope is that you would go to them lovingly and try to help support them and gently guide them back onto a different path. We have to create that path. We have a responsibility to do that. And I see people doing that all over. And that's what keeps me going, because people say, how can you do this work when you're immersed in these legal battles that seem to go nowhere all the time? It must be frustrating. It must drive you crazy. You must get burnt out. And what keeps me going are faces just like yours in rooms all over the world. And so we have this prophecy that has become really mainstream. And I was very fortunate as a young woman to be at an elders gathering out west and to sit by a fire and hear this story for the first time out of the mouth of Thomas Binyaka, who was a Hopi elder. And this story is a story of the Rainbow Warriors. And what that story tells us, this prophecy tells us, is that at a time when the earth is ravaged and all of the animals are dying, there will be a new tribe of people that will rise up all over the world. They'll come from all different directions, all different places, all different races, and they will unify and help to make the earth green again. And so what I'm seeing now is this rising up in consciousness, and I think that one of the things that I try to point out to people is that this is a really exciting time, because we are, perhaps for the first time in history, consciously aware that we are in the process of an evolutionary leap. We see it happening. We see the transformations happening. We see the awakening happening. And we're in the midst of that, and we have the opportunity to guide that. And so I guess my final thought for you today is to be mindful of your place in creation. Be mindful of your place in your community. And be mindful of your place in one another's lives, because we all belong to one another. We're all family, and we're all connected, and we're connected to all living beings throughout creation. And if we can get that one thing, there's no end to what we can accomplish. Thank you.